Please go ahead. The call is now being recorded.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon to everyone. On today's IRTP call on Tuesday, the 1st of February, we have Michele Nelon, Barbara Steele, Mike O'Connor, James Bladel, Kevin Erdman, Barry Cobb, Matt Serlin, Bob Mountain, Ollie Hope, Paul Diaz, Simonetta Bottega, Chris Chaplow. From staff, we have Marika Konings, myself, Gisela Gruber-White, and apologies today noted from Anil George and Boudouin Chambé. Can I please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes? Thank you. Over to you, Michele.
Well, thank you. It's Michele. As per usual, I will ask you all, have any of you got any updated statements of interest or declarations of interest at this time? Going once, going twice, sold. Okay, nobody's got any change of statement of interest. Right. Okay, then, there's been some activity, thankfully, on the mailing list, and we've had some input on various action points, which is great. At this juncture, I'll hand over to Marika, who's going to cover item number two. Please bear with Marika. She's technically challenged today, I believe. Marika, over to you.
I'm not technically challenged, but more socially challenged, because my little daughter is at home and she's ill, so you might hear some noise at the background from time to time, but I'll try to be on mute for most of the time. Just very briefly on item two, the EPP status values overview. I sent it out some time ago, and I actually owe you an updated version because I got some further comments internally. But I wanted to know if there are any other changes that people are going to make, or if people want more time to review it, just so I have an idea what is the expectation and how we can move ahead on that document and getting it up on the website.
So, anybody have anything to add here? Marika? You're just looking for more input from us, is it?
This is Marika. Just wanting to know if people are still planning to make comments or, you know, whether I can just go ahead. I can send out the latest version that I have that has some changes, as I said, from someone inside ICANN, or whether people still want some additional time to look over it and provide feedback.
Okay, well, just speaking as myself, I'm not going to give you any more feedback at this juncture. Does anybody on this call have any plans to give any further feedback or input into that document? Simonetta says no. James has a hand up. Go ahead, James.
Yes, just which document? Are we talking about the final report or the recommendations report? I'm a little
lost. No, we're talking about EPP status values document.
Okay. I have no other input in that. Thanks.
That is that, isn't it, Marika? I'm not being
stupid. That's right. So I'll send the updated version around for one more time and give people another week if they still want to make comments. And following that, I'll give it back to our communications department and hope they can already post it somewhere on the current website. And as soon as the GNSO new website goes live, there should be a separate section on IRTP, and it should be included in that part as well.
Okay, perfect. Right then, moving on. Recommendation two, we discussed that a bit at the last meeting. Marika and I reached out to various people in ESSAC, and they have not replied to us at all yet. So the status on that particular item is there is no status because they haven't replied. Now, James, you're on number four. Did you send that through? I think I saw an email from you earlier.
Yes, I sent an email. Is Simonette on this week's call?
Yes, I am.
Okay. She's there.
So what I tried to do was capture her feeling. I think the first thing was not to necessarily recommend a policy, but to recommend the initiation of an issues report. Just some other kind of language changes, but I think I captured everything. The one thing I would say I left out was the differing authority levels between the registered name holder and the administrative contract contact between transfers and change of control. You know, I think that that should be something that perhaps we could include, but I didn't want the issues report to presume that that was, you know, I didn't want to give the issues report too much leading, too many leading questions, so I wanted to leave that a little more open-ended. But otherwise, I think it's fairly the same, and I hope that she accepts it as a friendly amendment and not a material change to what she was proposing.
Simonetta, come on, repost.
No, I'm happy with the language suggestion. I'm not a stickler with my prior wording. I threw it out as a draft to discuss, so I like what James made out of this, and I have no issues with that.
Okay, so can I take it then that you're happy to replace your suggestion with James's?
Absolutely.
Okay. Does anybody else on this call have any issues with this? Matt, go ahead.
Hello. Just one.
Do I need to get more pins for you, by the way?
Just one small little nitpicky thing.
Aha. Sorry, go ahead.
I would like to see the word aftermarket taken out in the second paragraph. The workgroup, also known as the IRTP, is widely used in the domain name aftermarket community. I believe that it's actually just widely used in the domain name community. So I would just suggest that we take out the word aftermarket.
I think that's a good idea.
Ms. McKaylee, I would also support that. I would actually further add that I like where we don't refer with that too specific a language to too specific a subset.
Yep.
For God's sake, they might have decided to call themselves something totally different in 6 months' time.
Exactly.
I mean, it's silly. If we can remove that kind of specificity in that realm, much better. Thank you. You're off the hook now for the next week. I'll leave you. You're doing well. Right. Anybody else have any other input, thoughts, or anything else on recommendation 4? Going once, going twice, fine, moving on. Chris.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chris. You did your homework as well, and you sent round a document this afternoon. Have you got that there, Marieke, on your end? That you can put it up on the screen so everybody can see it?
It's coming up.
Okay, just bear with us. Okay, here we go. Okay, Chris, would you mind going through this, please?
Yes, certainly. What it was to try and look at the different roles, the different cases. So I put it into 4 columns. The first column, who the registrant is, second, who the admin contact is, and then a description really of what was happening, and then a comment that we can add. So hopefully I'm sort of heading in the right direction here, and I was racking my brains to try and find all the different scenarios, all the major scenarios.
Okay, this is something that you... Who gave you input into this so far, just so we're clear?
I've just done it all. I've just done it myself. I looked in the issues report at the sometimes quoted GoDaddy statement, but it doesn't talk... It just talks about registrant and about admin contact. And I looked at our definitions from very early days, and I tried to find some of our discussions on this, but I've not found anything... I'll have to look a little bit harder back to our transcripts and some of our mailing list about that time. So it's very much a work in progress. And if this is the right format, if people think this is the right sort of thing that we can improve and drop in an appendix,
Okay, perfect. So, so if people have suggestions for other things, once you've walked us through these, then they can be added into this.
Yes. Yeah. So perfect. Really, it would be good to add as many in as possible, and then work backwards and take some out that we think are just too similar and cloud the whole thing. So I've got examples there where we've got a company that's the registrant, obviously. And then the admin contact, an employee or ex-employee, and the company director is coming up and talking to a registrar and claiming the authority and asking to get the transfer reversed. And that must be, I said in the note, it's within the scope of what we're about here, and it's quite a common example, I would have thought. And then some other different scenarios, again with company, a director as opposed to an employee. We've got one director claiming authority over another director, and that would be out of our scope. I haven't put it in those words, but I just asked the question, how can the registrar make a judgment on this?
Okay, just 1 second. Kevin has his hand up. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, this is Kevin. I just wanted to make a comment. I don't know if this has to do with a difference in law between jurisdictions, but under U.S. law, the company director really wouldn't have any authority to do any of these actions. Rather, it would be a corporate officer that would be. I don't know if that really...
The same, Kevin. I think under Irish law, it's pretty much the same thing. It's a director means is usually a shareholder who sits on the board of a company. So in most businesses, like I'm a 50% shareholder in my company, I would be a company director, and God forbid you would try to stop me doing anything with an asset belonging to the company.
Yeah, but an officer could certainly do that.
But a company director definitely has the power.
Yeah, so Chris here. We want to try and denationalize it in some way with perhaps a better wording. But the point we're trying to make is somebody with high authority, the highest authority in the company.
Yeah. No, I agree. I just think we, from a U.S. law perspective, a director wouldn't have authority to do that. So
a chair, you're saying that if I established a company in the U.S. and I was the sole shareholder, I wouldn't have the authority.
Not as a shareholder. As an officer, you would.
Oh, I see what you're doing. Oh, okay. So you're making the distinction between a shareholder and an officer. Okay.
Yeah, you know, if you're the president or the vice president or the treasurer, then you would be able to, you know, sign documents and bind the corporation. But if you're a director, the only thing you have to do is you can vote on whether to retain or fire the president, but you can't bind the corporation to, for instance, a domain name registration.
Okay.
So I mean, as long as we have a word in there that
maybe CEO, Chris speaking here.
Yeah.
Because it conveys that authority and is fairly internationally recognized now.
Yeah. James, go ahead.
I'm probably going to be difficult or expose my ignorance with this statement. So I appreciate the effort that went into tracking down these various use cases, but, I think from a perspective of policy development, we have to just be somewhat agnostic to all these differences. If a company were a public corporation that hired a janitorial service and made its janitor the administrative contact of its domain name, that would be very, very dumb of them, but they're certainly allowed to do that, and we would have to treat that name, that registration, accordingly. So I wonder if going into this level of detail is clarifying the process or complicating it. And so I'm just putting that out there. What is our ultimate goal of this exercise?
If you read the quote by Sir Berry just at the head of the table there, I went back to the transcript of our call, and that's where it came from.
This is Michele. I mean, James, I understand where you're coming from. I think the problem that we were trying to address was tracing back to just see which kind of situations would be within scope and which weren't. So I think what Chris is doing, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, was iterating through all the possible situations, throwing them down, and then just kind of putting what's saying was in scope or out of scope. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, Michele, I was actually sitting here with the same kind of thoughts that James eloquently described. I guess I'm not sure that it's possible really to capture all the different scenarios that one might run into in this. And so I worry when we're looking at policy development that we're, looking at this set of half a dozen or so different scenarios, if that's really adding value at the end of the day. I'm personally not sure it is.
Okay. James?
Yeah, I think Matt hit on it when you're thinking, I don't think we can anticipate all the permutations. I think that we could probably go and talk to our escalation customer support folks and buy them a couple of beers, and they would tell you some really amazing stories about what they've encountered out there in the wild. I think the bottom line is that registered name holders are going to organize themselves and behave as they see fit and as they feel is best for them. And we as registrars have to manage and deal with that. And I want to be sure that we're not trying to capture all possible permutations, because I don't think that that's practical. And I want to be sure that we're not trying to do so in a way that writes policy that somehow takes into account all of the possible dispute legal questions involved in the domain name dispute, because I don't think that's possible either. So that's just my thinking, and I will drop off and stop being so difficult now. Thanks.
Thanks, James, and believe me, you're not that difficult. We've got Matt for that. It's okay. Sorry, Matt. Mikey and then Chris.
This is Mikey. I'm back from my little two-week ICANN vacation, so I'm coming up to speed. But I don't imagine, I'm putting words in Chris's mouth, maybe, and maybe Barry's too, I don't imagine that the goal of this document is to define every use case. I think the goal is probably to document enough so that we can test our policy and make sure we're not making a blunder. But I wouldn't expect that this document would become part of the policy. It's just an analysis tool. And so I'm less skeptical than James and Matt on this one.
Okay, just Mikey, just a follow-up before you go. Where would you see this fitting in as part of a report? I mean, where would you tack it on? I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying, and I don't disagree with you. I'm just at the question I suppose I'm asking is, how does one include that / capture that in a fashion that doesn't make make it to appear to be, how do I word this, some kind of final discussion to end all discussions on the topic, if that makes some kind of sense to you?
I think you do it the same way you do it with any analysis document. You stick it in the appendix. You say, well, this is a document that we wrote that we used to test some of the facets of the policy that we actually wrote. It's not part of the you put a bunch of disclaimers around it so that people would know that it's not part of the policy. Because I think one of the things that we don't want to do is get way down in the weeds on every single word and phrase. You know, we get into CEO versus director and all that kind of stuff. I think we sort of lost the value of this. What we're really trying to do is throw out a bunch of use cases and then test the policy that we've written to make sure that we haven't got something that's broken. And once the test is done, you put the testing gizmo in the appendix and just say, that's all this is. This is just an analysis we use to test our policy, but don't use it to interpret the policy. The policy stands on its own.
Okay, thank you. Simonetta, and then Bob.
I agree with putting this in the appendix, and I think one thing we could do with this collection of use cases is we could structure it and say that we found examples of when it is relatively clear that someone has the authority to make a decision on a domain name, and then give a few of these examples where it says within scope, and that's where you as a registrar can start acting without having to give this to some kind of dispute resolution process, and then also say we found other examples of when a dispute arises and a registrar can't just make a judgment, and those are cases such as XYZ, and there's a few examples of these in this list as well, and then say that, okay, this is the reason why we said the current policy is sufficient, and it isn't that easy to come up with a fast return mechanism that does all these use cases justice. And I think that's what this collection of use cases does show.
Okay, thanks, Simonetta. And then Bob? Bob, are you on mute?
Rash, I was. And I sounded so elegant to myself. No, Mikey and Simonetta made the points I was going to make. I think it's a good working document to kind of highlight the different scenarios. And for that, I think it's a useful document. I think the points were well made to avoid getting into the weeds, but I do like it for that reason.
Okay, thank you. Any other thoughts on this? One possible suggestion would be to put it into the working group's deliberations. You know, that as part of the deliberations, we looked at some. I mean, if we worded something like, you know, some but not all possible scenarios, just to get a better understanding of where it was applicable. Okay, then. Now, where are we at? Recommendation number 5, proposed modified recommendation submitted by James and amended by Barbara. Okay. Now, this is between James and Barbara. Ladies first, I would say.
This is Barbara, obviously. What do you want me to do, just to defend what I've put forward, or?
There was a lady and a gentleman, and my mother brought me up. She didn't drag me up, so I was also going to give you the first option.
Okay, I basically just put it out there as an option, since, you know, I've seen more and more online transactions requiring a positive confirmation. I thought it might be a good direction to go to, even though it's quite a departure from the direction that the IRTP has used in the past for confirming transfers.
Okay.
I don't have any strong feelings about it one way or the other.
Okay.
Am I in the right place, Michele? I thought we were talking about the reason for denial.
Oh, well, this is quite possible as well, because you have to remember that my brain only works at two speeds. One is slow and one is very slow. Well, so I'm looking at the agenda on the right-hand side here. Recommendation number 5, proposed modified recommendation submitted by James and amended by Barbara. So this...
I may be on the wrong one as well.
Maybe not, but... Oh, sorry, yeah. Okay, you were talking about recommendation number 9. That's what we're talking... Okay, this is what the source of confusion is. Okay. Recommendation 5 is relation to the denial reasons at number 6.
Yeah, and this is James. I'll raise my hand.
No, go ahead. That's fine. I recognize you, James.
Okay, so I tried to put together some draft language, and Barbara, I think your primary edit was to remove the last phrase, which was something with the reasonably accessed method to remove the lock subject to the terms and conditions limitations of the registration agreement. And I think that was your only change, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I have asked internally our legal folks if they're okay with this. I haven't received a response yet. Let me follow up on that now. I think that as long as it doesn't explicitly say that we can't use, you know, something different in our registration agreement, I think that we're fine with this change. But, you know, we certainly don't want, I understand that we don't want policy to, you know, take a back seat to individual registration agreements, but we also don't want to weaken those agreements and say that, you know, regardless of whatever contract you've signed with your registrar, you know, you can always trump that, I guess, or something. So, you know, I just want to make sure that there's a balance there. That's all. So I should have something back here fairly shortly. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have any other thoughts, comments? Mikey? And Marika?
Let Marika go first.
Yeah, this is Marika. I just wanted to point to the comments that you see at the bottom of the Adobe Connect screen, and I've also included in the email that I circulated late last week. Those are some comments I received internally, and in relation to the proposed version by Barbara, it was pointed out that this version actually does not mandate the removal of the lock. So the proposed changes do not seem to provide much more clarity, but merely maintain or expand the status quo. And the suggestion was that the working group might want to consider adding something like end up on the request by the transfer contact. The registrar must remove the lock or provide a reasonable, accessible method for the transfer contact to remove the lock within 5 calendar days, and that after the word basis, which you can find above.
Okay. Mikey?
Again, I'm sort of coming back up to speed, but it seems like James's suggestion pretty much guts the recommendation. So I guess I'm not real enthusiastic about it. I like the notion that Marika is talking about a lot better. Seems like otherwise, what's the point?
James?
Well, certainly not our intention to gut the recommendation, Mike. Yeah, I'm not sure that that's the best characterization of what we're trying to do here. We want to ensure that registrars have flexibility to develop services, products and services, and then offer those with some reasonable expectation for continuity of the agreements that they've signed with their registrar. With their customers. So I'm just trying to maintain a balance here. I think I'm okay with the idea of having a specified time frame by which the registrar has to remove the lock upon request from the registrant. I think that's actually helpful. So if we want to find a place to shoehorn that language back into this recommendation, I would support that.
Okay, thank you. Simonetta and Mikey, do you have any comeback as well? And based on James's reply?
I think it's... I, 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 cl- clearly have to do a lot of homework here, but if we're basically saying that the gist of what I hear from James is that no policy should in any way impact the contracts between registrants and registrars. And, you know, if that's our premise, then that's nice. We can dust our hands together and say we're done. But that's not what we're about. What we're about is trying to get some structure that's consistent across these that registrants can count on. And so I'm not keen on the idea of tilting the balance towards varying contracts between registrars and their customers, because if that's really where we're headed, that's great, but then, you know, we might as well just hang up ICANN altogether, call it quits.
James and Simonetta. Sorry, Simonetta, but I think James has a right to reply.
I just wanted to emphasize that's not what we're, that's not why the direction I feel that we're going. I'm just trying to leave some differentiation for all the different registrar models, and not essentially try to rewrite the registration agreement into ICANN policies so that the experience is commoditized. You know, I think that there's a lot of different businesses out there offering a lot of different products in conjunction with domain name registration. And that, you know, we just, the policy needs to have some clear demarcations where those kinds of differentiations can take place. I'm not at all saying that, you know, that registration agreements trump policy. I'm not trying to say that at all. I'm saying that we need to have this balance. Mikey, I don't think we should hang it up. I don't think that that's the direction this is going at all.
Simonetta?
I just wanted to say that I'm honestly a little bit confused about the language of the recommendation, because when I'm reading through the original text in the IRTP, it speaks about reasons why a registrar may deny a transfer. And reason number 6 is that the transfer contact has, what does it say exactly? Expressed written objection to the transfer from the transfer contact. So my understanding is that on the losing registrar's side, the transfer contact says, no, I disagree with the transfer of this name. Is that right? So
they have no way to say that, or they have to say that, sorry.
Well, in the current wording of the policy says, upon denying a transfer request for any of the following reasons, the registrar of record must provide the registered name holder and the potential gaining registrar with the reason for denial. The registrar of record may deny a transfer request only in the following specific instances, and then there's evidence of fraud, UDRP, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's express written objection to the transfer from the transfer contact. For example, email, fax, paper document, or other processes by which the transfer contact has expressly and voluntarily objected through opt-in means. So what we're speaking about now is about removing locks, and I'm just a little confused by that, because it seems to me that I don't know where this language isn't clear and how our recommendation clarifies it.
Okay. Does anybody want to volunteer some thoughts on this?
This is Marika. Sorry, I haven't raised my hand yet, but I think we do have some notes on that issue, because I think this is an issue that was also raised by ICANN compliance, and also based on some comments I think that were made by George Kirikos at the time in relation to the definition of voluntarily. So I'm happy to look back and send out that language again to the list. And I think it might also be covered in some of the notes that are in the draft final report. I've tried to capture discussion around this issue and the reason why we've moved to this this recommendation.
Okay, thanks, Marika. Matt?
Yeah, I was just to pick up on what Marika said, my understanding on the goal here is the notion that we're not just actually denying a specific transfer request, but what we're trying to address is that some registrars have, through their services that they provide or their registration agreement, essentially given registrants the ability to just block transfer requests in a blanket sort of manner. So that's why the language here talks about a general objection to all transfer requests. Just to go back to maybe playing referee between James and Mikey, I actually see both of their points. I think the language is generally okay. The thing that I do kind of worry about, and Mikey kind of touched on it, is it does, you know, someone could read this and interpret it to mean that, you know, this policy essentially gives a registrar the ability through their registration document, which, let's face it, not probably more than 0.5% of people actually read the whole thing, the ability to, you know, slip language in there that gives them the ability to indefinitely, based on this language, block all transfer requests. And that, that does give me pause, I suppose.
Okay.
And this is James. That gives me pause as well. Thanks, Matt.
Yeah.
All right, then. Maybe for the sake of clarity, sanity, and world peace, Marika could circulate the updated version with the including the proposed additions to the list, and then maybe we can have a look at it. There also seems to be a little bit of confusion with respect to exactly what people are talking about, possibly because there's lots of numbers. Marika, then James.
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to clarify, so we're talking now about the version that Barbara has proposed with the addition that is suggested in the comments, correct?
I think so, yes.
Okay, I can get it out to the list, and I can add to that then the discussion notes on this issue that, you know, hopefully provide the background to the discussion we're having.
Okay. James?
Yep, I just wanted to say pretty much the same thing Marika said, that we are talking about Barbara's version. I would add that we are also perhaps exploring ways to include the explicit time frame which the registrar has to remove the lock of the 5 calendar days after basis. That was all I wanted to add there.
Okay. Right then. Now, moving on. We're talking here about, sorry, getting messages from people sending me weird things, people asking to leave voicemails on my phone. I don't even know how to listen to the voicemails on my phone. Hold on a second. Somebody's changed. Marika, have you skipped ahead?
Sorry, I thought we're moving to the next item. Did I go too fast?
I'm
going to go back to recommendation 5.
I'm confused now. You've confused me. Hold on. There's recommendation 5 and there's recommendation... I thought there was a second part to this. Oh, Marika's right. Okay, James is telling me that Marika's right and I'm wrong, so I'm an idiot. Okay. All right, thank you, James. Why don't you just say Michaeli is an idiot and let's get over it. Okay, then. Recommendation 7, the working group recommends standardizing and clarifying who is status messages regarding register lock status. The goal of these changes is to clarify why the lock has been applied and how it can be changed. Based on discussions with technical experts, the working group does not expect that such a standardization and clarification of who is status messages would require significant investment or change at the registrar level. The working group recommends that ICANN staff is asked to develop an implementation plan for community consideration, which ensures that a technically feasible approach is developed to implement this recommendation. Go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. The main question in relation to this recommendation is I've added the underlined sentence based on the discussions we had some time ago, and just to basically ask the group if people are comfortable with that language. And there was a message from Barry, he said that he's fine with that, and I just want to make sure that people had a chance to look at it and you know, indicate if they're not comfortable with it, and otherwise we can hopefully note it down as a unanimous consensus.
Okay. Does anybody have any issues? Okay, boys and girls, would you stop arguing about whether we're going to be going to Singapore or Jordan? Eyes on the ball, guys. Eyes on the ball. Does anybody have any issues with the under the sentence, the addition of the sentence? Okay, Paul Diaz, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Michele. No issue. I in fact strongly support it and think it needs to be in there, based on all the discussions we previously had. I think it captures the concerns that I expressed very well. I'd like to see it go forward.
Okay, thank you very much. Right then. So unless we hear otherwise, we have what's the term again, Marika? Unanimous consensus or something?
Right.
Sorry?
Yes, that's right. Unanimous consensus.
Okay, sorry. Perfect. Okay, then. Woohoo! Next. Oh, God, help. Recommendation number 9, new. Okay, this is one that's kind of causing backwards and forwards, and... Okay, how do we want to deal with this? Does anybody want to throw themselves on a sword here? Oh, okay, got volunteers. Okay, Matt, go ahead.
Well, I don't know if I'm throwing myself on the sword. I guess I'll admit to I haven't weighed in on this previously, but just reading this, you know, the one issue that I have is that we're talking about a piece of data that isn't publicly available. So we're talking about the losing registrar that has access to an email address that's not visible on the WHOIS record, could potentially lead to problems. So that, you know, if I have a client that, you know, maybe doesn't have a relationship with that registrar, or the domain was registered by someone in the company that isn't around anymore, or whatever it is, you know, I'm not really able to help them much because I can't look at a WHOIS record and say, oh, the email is being sent here or anything like that. So I think it's problematic. How about that?
Hold on a second, Matt. Just explain your logic to me here. The email's being sent where, and why is that problematic?
The recommendation says the registrar of record has access to the contact information for the registrant and could modify their systems to automatically send out the FOA to the registrant.
Right.
But, again, that's a piece of data that isn't... I can't look at a WHOIS record and say to my customer that's trying to transfer a domain name, the email address for the transfer is being sent here. It's upon the registrant to contact the losing registrar to say, where is this email being sent? I can't...
Okay, hold on a second. Stop. Okay, hold on. So just so I can understand exactly what you're saying.
Yes.
Is this from the perspective of the losing registrar or the gaining registrar? Because I think you need to make that clear.
I'm talking about the position it puts potentially the registrant of the domain name that wants to transfer the domain to a new registrar.
Okay.
And let's just suppose that they don't have any relationship with the current registrar for whatever reason. The name was registered by an employee that isn't there anymore, or whatever the case is.
Why does that change anything compared to the current state, the current situation?
It doesn't. I'm saying I think that, you know, we've gone back and forth about whether or not we should recommend that, you know, a thick WHOIS model would help the IRTP process. I think this is a perfect example of why it would.
Okay. All right. James, Bob, then Simonetta. And for the record, Matt, you've confused me.
Go ahead, Michele, or...
Sorry?
You want me to go ahead?
Oh, yeah, no, please do, because it's 10 to the hour.
It sounded like you were going to say something there. This is James speaking.
No, I'm going to leave it as a plain statement. Matt has confused me.
Okay, and I think my concern is different than Matt, and I put this into my email last night, which I apologize for the delay. A lot of folks may have not had a chance to see that. My primary concern with this recommendation is that it makes the transfer process dependent upon actions of the losing registrar. And I think that that is a fundamental change in the equilibrium, if you will, of the current process. And I'm not sure of what that means in terms of possible consequences, but I'm concerned that they could be significant unanticipated consequences for that. So I would very strongly oppose any proposal that that may the transfer process dependent upon actions of the losing registrar.
Okay, Bob, and then Simonessa, but let's let Marika slip in sideways first. Go ahead, Marika.
This is Marika. I'm also happy to go to the end of the queue. I just wanted to know, because indeed the concern that James expressed is some of the similar concerns I've heard internally in ICANN, where you know, we went through some of the recommendations. One alternative approach that has been suggested there, and of course it's not a golden bullet, but it might provide some additional notice to the registrar that a name is being transferred, is indeed requiring the losing registrar to provide notice to the registrar, but not allow that as a reason to deny the transfer. So that might be an additional way that the registrar gets notice, and if there is a potential conflict, to start addressing it at that stage before the transfer is actually already taken place. So that might be an alternative approach and maybe alleviate some of the concerns. But as I said, of course, it's not a magic solution, because it wouldn't probably solve all the issues that arise, and you still have the fact that you cannot check where that email has gone, and it might not reach the actual person that's responsible for the transfer. Just a suggestion.
Bob?
Yeah, I was actually going to make a point. You know, I think the inaction stopping the transfer is really problematic. I think we'll see transfers just getting completely gummed up. Both either,
Sorry, just to cut across here, just as a point of information, you do realize that registrars can do that now, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And yes. So I think the problem is if there's inaction on their part, which stops it, which stops the transfer, either on the registrant or the registrar, I think that could be certainly on our end, that could be a problem. So I'd be in favor of not implementing policies that would create that.
Okay.
McKelly, this is James. Can you explain what you just said? Because I think you lost me there for a second when you said
okay,
that they can
sorry,
do that.
Sorry, no,
now.
But they. Okay, as things stand at present, a lot of registrars, not all, but a lot, send out an email in compliance with the existing policy to inform the registrant of the outbound transfer. The difference is between what is being proposed and what exists. In my understanding, is that currently the registrars are not obliged to send those emails, and that if the registrant does not do anything after 5 days, the domain will transfer automatically. A lot of registrars use those emails to offer the registrant the option to block the transfer there and then, or to expedite the transfer there and then. So, for example, I was transferring some domains from one registrar over to ourselves, domains that I'd registered myself before we were accredited. With some of the registrars, you can expedite it so that once you get this email from NetSol or Enom or whoever, if I click on the link saying, yes, I want to confirm this, then they immediately acknowledge it over EPP to the gaining registrars and the registries and all these things, and the domain is immediately on our accreditation. Whereas otherwise I would have to wait 5 days, and if I click on the no, I deny it, then the transfer is blocked immediately. One registrar words the email in such a fashion that you will end up clicking on it, thinking it is similar to the other registrars, and by clicking on the link in the email, you deny the transfer immediately. That's what I was referring to. Simonetta and then Barbara, and we've got 4 minutes left, so please be brief.
I'll try. I completely agree with what James's points are, and I also think what Marika says and what I was writing can actually be pulled together, because while I disagree with a inaction resulting in denial of the transfer, I do agree with the losing registrar sending out an email that gives the registrant an option to either immediately acknowledge or deny the transfer. It would be desirable to have the same message be sent from everybody. So I'm actually surprised, because it was my understanding that the FOA text is something that is standard and should be used in the same wording by everybody. So maybe the recommendation could be that the text pieces should be standardized, but I would disagree with an inaction being interpreted as denial.
Okay,
and
thank
if
you.
If we do choose to go down that route, we would have to make sure that we do adjust the current wording templates, because the current wording templates do say clearly on the gaining side that if you do confirm this will prove that you want the domain name to be transferred, and on the losing side it clearly states if you don't do anything, this means that the transfer will go through. And my last comment on this would be, if we wanted to change this is such a fundamental change to how transfers are done that I do believe for this piece we would have to go back to the community and solicit further input and comments.
Okay. Barbara, and then Mikey, and then that is the end of the queue.
Hi, it's Barbara. I actually think that what Marika had put forward is a rather good compromise, where the losing registrar would be required to send out the standardized FOA to confirm the transfer, but then if they don't respond, then to allow it to continue. So I think it's kind of a hybrid of what I proposed and what the current policy stipulates. But I think if we could change it to mandatory with no confirmation, meaning the transfer would proceed, I would be happy with that approach as well.
Okay, thank you. Mikey?
Like they said, actually Barbara said almost word for word what I was going to say.
Okay. So Mikey had the last word, but it's actually Barbara's word. No, Simonetta, no, I'm afraid not. It's 4 o'clock on the dot. Sorry, Simonetta, if you want to follow up on the mailing list, please do. Barry, are you going to take over for anything further now, or what's happening?
Yeah, we'll continue on for a little bit.
Okay, perfect. Well, in that case, I will speak to you all next week, and thanks for all your input, and keep it up on the list. I think this is good, and we're actually moving forward, and I'm very happy about that. And I'll speak to some of you later this evening. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye, McKinley.
Bye, McKinley.
Bye, McKinley. Okay, for those that remain on the call, I'm going to start off by stating that this is the last time we're going to have the second hour call, because half of the people that are interested can't stay on anyway. I had asked for ETRP to be a line item on the first half of the agenda, but we'll push that to next week. So all I'm going to do today is just briefly go over the swim lane diagrams, and imagine we'll go ahead and terminate this early. I sent around the PDFs last week. There were three PDFs, three of them. One of them outlining IRTP and TDRP in the current state, the second one being a proposed state of IRTP and TDRP if in the context of an ERTP kind of solution, and then the third document was an extremely rough draft of probable areas in the two existing policy documents that would need to be modified or if we were to implement some sort of urgent return kind of procedure. So Marika didn't get the PDF files up, she did. PDF files are loaded up in the window. Not sure how clear they'll come in on your end. The first one, which I believe that is loaded, is the current date.
Barry doesn't work. I want to have up. Is it proposed one? Do you want the current
negative
one?
No, you're perfect. Thank you. So yeah, I won't waste anybody's time on reviewing through the current state diagrams. Like I said on the last call, I imagine that there is, it's definitely not 100% perfect. I'm sure there's a couple of activity boxes that need to be modified here and there, but it's definitely pretty close. I got people trying to get in. All right. At any rate, so I think on page 2 of the loaded PDF is the proposed state for some sort of urgent return. And what I tried to accomplish here is anything that was newly introduced, that decision or activity box is highlighted with a background red and white text and or other little small diagram pieces that are highlighted with red text. But as I've tried to summarize in the past, I think where ETRP wanted to go practically already exists in the current policies today. The only thing that we're really trying to add here is a line item that calls out an urgent return in the case of a hijack, and so that part of the procedure would need to be updated, and then basically what would need to be bolted onto this is how such a procedure would be initiated in the case of hijack, and then lastly is how would that be delivered once it was invoked and the time frame for which it would be delivered. So with that said, I invite people to kind of zoom out on the spreadsheet, or I'm sorry, on the PDF attachment on the swim lanes. And I'm just going to go through this pretty quickly. Again, I'm on page 2, which is the IRTP proposed swim lane. There are 7 total swim lanes on the IRTP diagram. The first 2 denote the difference between the registrant and the admin contact, or more formally designated as the registered name holder versus the admin contact. Then we have 2 swim lanes that denote the gaining and losing registrars. Then we have the registry. Then we have ICANN. And then the last line is basically miscellaneous other systems. Typically use that when you're going to start invoking some of the process stuff and integrating it kind of as a first step to your system requirements. The idea of the swim lane is that it moves top down, left to right, left top being the beginning and usually the top right being the end of the process. In summary, basically what happens is the registrant or the admin contact initiates the transfer, the FOA gets sent, there's logic that determines whether the FOA was authorized. Then it kicks over from the losing registrar perspective and whether they optionally send the FOA. There's the approval logic on the back end if they choose to do it and or deny the transfer and a NAC is sent, et cetera, all the way up to where the domain is transferred and then it ends out. So that's kind of a quick synopsis of the current state. The proposed state, which doesn't necessarily fit in to the logic of a true swim lane, and what I've tried to accomplish here with the red diagrams that you see to the right-hand side, there are parallel lines that sit above these activity boxes and decision boxes. And the reasoning for this is that really these types, this invoke of any kind of urgent return, the double lines actually stipulate that this is a parallel process that runs along the overall process. And so the intent here is that any kind of procedure can be invoked at any time along this process. This isn't the most cleanest way to do it, but for now it serves its purpose. And the other thing that I would point out to you in trying to decipher this diagram is that often when two roles can perform the same task, I've kind of provided you a little bit of both. When you look at the two top swim lanes for the admin contact and registered name holder, either role can perform those activities. And when you break it out where each activity aligns to a particular swim lane, you immediately get the takeaway of how complex that part of the process can be because two different roles are performing identical procedures. The secondary method for sharing decisions and activities and diagrams like this is that you, and I'll point back to the red boxes, is that they actually hover on the middle line that delineates the both roles. And so you'll see that for when the registrant would like to invoke an urgent return, the parallel procedure that a registrar or gaining or losing registrar would invoke if they recognized a transfer dispute. And then as well, back on to the left-hand side is the dispute procedure itself. Again, both gaining or losing registrars can conduct this procedure. I probably should shut up. Barbara, please go ahead.
I just had a question because I saw that you have transfer dispute mechanisms there at the registrar and the registrant level, but there's also, according to the policy, the transfer dispute process is available at the registry level if they're not able to work it out themselves. So I don't know if you also would want to put that piece in this diagram as well.
Okay, so to clarify on that, If I understand correctly, let's say there's a suspicious-looking transfer that just came across the wire. If I understood correctly, what you're saying is that the registry by themselves could say this is a suspicious-looking transfer and invoke a dispute resolution procedure about it, correct?
No, actually, that's not what I was saying. It's basically in the event that the registrars or the registrant primarily registrars, recognize a transfer dispute but are unable to resolve it between registrars and the impacted registrants, then the registrars would be able to go to the registry to request under the TDRP transfer.
Okay, correct. Okay, so, yeah, when I started diagramming this out, there's to answer your question, Barbara, yes, that procedure specifically isn't drawn out the way that it needs to be. What you're talking about in terms of that restore procedure and the three elements in the policy that can invoke that restore procedure is tried to be encapsulated in the TAN activity box that's labeled in the registry swim lane, invoke restore to original state for undo notice. And to the right of those activity diagrams is the text of that policy. And number one, again, as you pointed out, is that if both registrars agree that this restore needs to be undone, they contact the registry and it gets undone within 5 days. This is the exact procedure that I'm targeting for the expedited restore. But what is missing from that existing procedure is the criteria by which it gets invoked and then the time frame in which the restore would be done. And based on previous conversations of ETRP, it doesn't seem like 5 calendar days would be quick enough, and so that would definitely be the point. I need to step back up to the 90,000-foot level real quick, because there are a couple of other pages in the document that's loaded into Adobe. The third page is kind of a mini sub-process about invoking the dispute procedures, and the TDRP lists a line item in the beginning of it that it wishes the registrar, the gaining and losing registrar, to work it out themselves, and then if they still can't work it out, then TDRP gets invoked. And so that's what I tried to capture here by this dispute procedure, that it didn't fit in the previous page swim lane, because it can be invoked at any particular time of the process, even as soon as you leave start all the way up to close to when the end is about to occur in the process. But it just didn't flow well, so I had to create it, move it over onto a third page that kind of separates it out specifically for the introduction of the proposed for the urgent return. I needed more space. And then lastly, the other thing I want to draw to your attention is page 4, which is the TDRP process, and what areas involved there would be required to make any change. And essentially, what we initially thought is, you know, if there was any kind of urgent restore that needed to be done, the problem with ETRP in its previous form is it was never intended to be a dispute resolution mechanism, but I don't think one of the shortcomings is that it was never directly tied to any dispute resolution mechanism. So that gap is what I tried to define here is, if there was an urgent restore that's requested, there's some sort of dispute that's going on behind it, so we've got to do something about it. And the informality of gaining and losing registrar working together and coming up with some sort of resolution kind of lost visibility, and the importance behind and or try to minimize gaining of somebody invoking an urgent restore on the back end. So that's why the proposal is that there is a level 0 that could be created in TDRP whereby that urgent restore gets documented, but the formal TDRP process isn't really invoked until the registrars at some point in time figured out that they couldn't work amongst themselves to resolve the issue. I'm probably doing a really crappy job of explaining this. So I think overall, you know, this has been out on the floor for a week. I'm just going to open it up for comments and questions, and I'll try to answer them. I imagine some of this may seem confusing, but I'm getting the impression that based on zero feedback from any of this, that nobody's really interested in moving forward, and it looks like, you know, I'm getting the feeling that ETRP, however, in its previous form or in this existing form, is going to be put to rest. The only other thing that the two things that I would say about it is, A, you know, it sounded like that there was definitely a need for this, so it'd be a shame for all of this work to get pushed to the side, even discounting what I've done here, but the ETRP work done up front, the contracted parties that participated on that seemed like this was a good thing, so seemed to me it'd be a waste if all of this just got pushed to the side. Lastly, I'll just point out that I think in IRTP Part D, which would be about 2020, that is a dispute resolution focused PDP, and perhaps we can address something back then, because again, an urgent restore is it is a dispute of whatever color you want to call it. So I'll open it up for questions or comments, and we'll move from there. Mikey.
This is Mikey. Thanks, Barry, for doing all this. I admit I've played hooky for 2 weeks, so I haven't reviewed it, but I will. I think the notion, in essence, for me, is that 6 years ago, the ESSAC came up with a recommendation that they handed off to the GNSO that said, "Dear GNSO, hijacking is a problem. You all should figure out a way to solve that if you can." And I think it would be a shame if the headline is, after 6 years of waiting, we said it's too hard. I just don't think that's an acceptable outcome. I think we have to drive something to ground, or go back to the ESSEC and say, you were wrong. Hijacking wasn't a problem. Current policy is sufficient. But I don't think, quote, too hard, unquote, is an acceptable way to end a policy discussion. I think we either have to make one up, or we have to say, no, it's not required. So I'm just going to lobby against the too hard outcome.
thank you, Mikey. Plus one in my department. Personally, even if it means missing a date that we're shooting for, it seems too important to just sweep under the rug again. But that's my own personal opinion. Simonetta.
I don't think that we don't have an outcome here. I think we do have an outcome, and that says that we recognize that the existing policy is what you should be moving through, even in case of hijacking. And I think we have three things a registrant can do in case of hijacking. First of all, they should be getting in touch with their losing registrar. In most cases, their losing registrar will be able to work it out with the new gaining registrar and help them. If they cannot help them, there's still two things left that the registrant can do. A, they can go to a court and get some kind of ruling from them that urgently restores the domain back, and then this court ruling takes care of the non-responsiveness of the new gaining registrar and all that stuff. And the second thing they can do is they can move through this existing policy piece. And I think if we can introduce one little piece there that basically says, in case someone files a dispute and they claim it's a hijacking case, it gets looked at with, I don't know, quicker speed or something like that, then we do have a very good three-step process that someone should follow in case they face a hijacking situation. And I think that is an outcome that we have looked into, and we tried to find a way to come up with something new, but we recognize that the existing process isn't as bad as we thought in the first place.
Great. Thank you, Simonetta. And I agree as well. Barbara.
And I think that actually the addition of that fourth reason for the registry operator to return or undo a transfer, I think makes a lot of sense. But I think that you need to put some parameters surrounding it that either the involved registrars, if a domain name has been reset, if you will, that the registrars involved have to either, you know, come to a final conclusion as to, you know, what did happen with that name within X period of time, and maybe it's 7 days. I don't think we should allow it to go on forever, or they would need to file a transfer dispute under the policy with the registry operator or the second level dispute resolution provider.
Great. Thank you, Barbara. And that's exactly what the idea behind the level zero addition to the TDRP was hoping to accomplish is, you know, when somebody hits the red button, this is pretty serious. It's some form of dispute. And like I said, we didn't want to take away the ability for registrars to work amongst themselves to get this done. But because the red button was hit, there's got to be consequence for hitting the red button blindly. and by invoking a level zero TDRP, documents the fact that this happened, and then be, you know, and it sounds like 99% of the time registrars are able to work amongst themselves. They've come up with the outcome, pass it on to their appropriate registry, and everybody's happy. But the 1% or half percent, I don't know what the numbers are, that it doesn't happen, you know, there needs to be retribution, I guess, for hitting the red button, and that was certainly one of the gaming comments that we received back in Brussels about the ETRP in its original form. The only other comment that I would add to what you said, Barbara, is I think one of the key elements to any kind of urgent restore is the time frame in which it was restored. And by my understanding of the original ETRP proposal, I believe it was almost at like a 48-hour turnaround time frame. And I was kind of surprised by that line item being in there from the from representation from the contracted parties, because you know that request could come in Friday night, and you have to have it done by Sunday, and you know, and that's not normal business hours. So my point is the time frame in which an urgent restore is performed, it needs to be probably less than the 5 calendar days that the policy stipulates today. But what would the registries be willing to sign up for that doesn't overly impact cost in doing the restore? So that's one of the issues that would be need to be worked out. And Barbara, I'm going to go ahead and let you respond to that since I was directed towards you.
Okay. This is Barbara. I'm assuming that rule is still applies that we have to say our name. Anyway, I think that maybe the way you word it is something like, you know, as soon as possible, but no later than 3 calendar days.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, that I'm definitely the last person that needs to craft policy language specific. I stick to the pictures. Thank you, Barbara. Mikey.
I'd be willing to go behind Chris since he hasn't spoken yet.
Okay, Chris, please.
Hi, Barry. Yeah, once again, thanks very much for doing all this. And obviously, you're pretty familiar with it, a lot more familiar than we are. But from where we're looking, it looks great. I'm just wondering where we are with this now in the overall. You did just sort of comment on that earlier, but I didn't quite understand, because this is a sub team that you're on now, if I'm not mistaken. I wasn't originally on the sub-team, but I, last week or the week before, saw so many people drop off the on the Adobe, and I thought, well, I better stay on, or you'll be talking to yourself. So, you said this is the last one. Is this sub-team now reporting back next week to the main team with a positive proposal, or is there something going on in the background that I've missed somewhere?
Well, to be honest, Chris, I guess I was probably just being hasty in my comment by not receiving any feedback about any of this. To be perfectly honest, I guess I kind of expected either someone from the registrars that had put a kibosh on the ETRP that they would either continue with the kibosh or start to support this. So I don't have any indication in that regard. But to answer your question, while the second proposal definitely needs to be further fleshed out in terms of the details, and certainly like the service levels that we just talked about, some of that needs to be refined. The only thing I know to do at this point is kind of take it back to the larger working group and say, all right, you know, we agree that ETRP in its previous form is dead. Here's the second proposal. What do you guys think? Should we continue on or just say that the working group couldn't come to consensus on it? I hope that it's A, but I'm not really sure what the next steps would be. Mikey.
Thanks, Barry. It's Mikey. I'm curious. I wrote a little draft with a couple of tweaks to insert into the existing ITRP and TDRP. And I'm curious, did that ever get to the subgroup during my two-week hiatus?
Yes, it was a third attachment as a PDF that still highlighted the yellow highlights that you provided. And I didn't make any edits to any of those. I left it in its form that you had left it at. And I just put the caveat that really the yellow highlights are the areas, the targeted areas that would need to be updated to match the proposal.
Is there a way to throw that up on the Adobe Connect real quick? Either you or Marika have godlike powers to do that?
I think I've got the godlike powers, but I haven't done that yet on the Adobe client, so it's going to take me a little bit. Marika, are you still online?
She may be tending that kid.
She said that she needed to drop off, so I think she did. I don't have the power to put it up here real quick. I'll try to find it. Otherwise, it was sent out, though, Mikey.
Let me walk folks through it, because I think that this actually could be pretty simple. And if anybody can find the document in their email queue, feel free to tag along. But basically, the only change to the IRTP is the addition of that fourth reason for denial. The notion of request by the registrar of record at the time of the time that the domain name was hijacked for the urgent restoration. And the only other change, I inserted a great big chunk of language out of the ESSAC report higher up in that document. Because what the ESSAC, you know, it sort of gave a nice piece of context that said, you know, here's what's going on, and here's sort of the texture of what the thing ought to look like. And the key concern that they had, which I think everybody shares, I mean, it's really the reaction from the community, is that this reason be crafted carefully enough that it can't be gamed, that it can't be used by all those use cases that we've talked about, the, you know, the buyer's remorse or the seller's remorse case. But really the only change in policy is the addition of one more reason. And then the other tweak comes in the TDRP. And again, the tweak is pretty minor and basically says that the TDRP gets invoked every time there's a dispute, instead of every time there's a dispute that can't be resolved by the registrars. But what that is really doing is just documenting, in most cases, these things. So, you know, I called it in the document the level zero activity in TDRP. And I think there, again, it would be a pretty minor affair in 99.9% of the cases, because that's the number, or at least that's the impression of my number of times that these disputes are actually just resolved between the gaining and losing registrar. But what it does is a couple of things. One, it builds a record of how often this all happens, and it gets us back to the boogeyman of no data. And what this would do is it would document all of the disputes, even the ones that are currently being resolved between registrars. So we would begin to get a sense of the scale of the problem. And if it turns out after a few years that we're writing policy that addresses, you know, 100 cases a year, then we've got a different situation than if we're writing policy that addresses 50,000, which right now it's very hard to know. The other thing that it does is gets the TDRP process started so that if it has to go to the second phase, the current first phase, that could happen a lot more quickly because the process would already be underway and we could take some of the delay out of it. I think with those two changes, carefully crafted, you know, but 1 to 2 sentence changes, we could pretty much lick this thing. That's just my sense. So I'd encourage folks to take a look at that little draft, kind of ignore all the ESSAC language except for the intent of that language, which is, you know, I just stapled the whole chunk of their report in there, but I wouldn't expect all that to be in the policy. And the last thing that the ESSAC was recommending, I'm not as I don't feel as strongly about. They had a recommendation that there be an emergency action channel with a bunch of metrics as to how fast that channel had to respond. I view that as something that may be a little overblown. It may be in most cases, especially in the large registrars, I'm sure that already exists, and it may not be appropriate. It may be, in fact, overly heavy-handed to put that in policy, but I left it in just because I just stapled the whole chunk of the report in there. So at a minimum, I would think of that as a first draft of a recommendation that we could hand back to the larger group and defend on the next call. That's my thought.
Thank you, Mikey. And just to add real quick, and then we'll move to Simonetta. Again, just to reiterate, the whole invoking of TDRP at the level zero, yes, it does provide the metrics. Yes, it would perhaps expedite moving to level one of the TDRP if it needed to go there. But I think the most important part is that most of the stakeholders that are involved with TDRP do recognize that it's not a cheap endeavor to go down, hence why it's probably not used very much in today's world. So the third goal of tying any urgent restore back to the TDRP is, again, to try to minimize or prevent it being gamed per the feedback that we got. And then there's just one minor correction, Mikey. In terms of documenting the hijacks and level zero being invoked, the only visibility to metrics that we get is for a hijack is if the urgent restore is invoked. If there are other transfer disputes that are being worked amongst the registrars themselves, we wouldn't have visibility into that. I guess it's only in the fact that if the urgent restore is invoked, that the level zero would be, the TDRP level zero would be invoked, and by which we document that. Simonetta.
I'm just trying to summarize so we have something that we can bring back to the group is what we're proposing, to say that we took a look at the proposal for ETRP and said this doesn't work. What we do think will work is to refer people back to the existing policy, let people know that they can go get a court order if they wish to do so, but first of all, they should start working through their existing registrar to help them attempt to solve the situation by directly talking to the gaining registrar. And then adding into the IRTP policy document two pieces, which is what Mikey said, registrars have a emergency phone number that is shared amongst the registrar group of our stakeholder group, so people can have access to somebody at any one registrar that they need to solve a situation with. And the second piece would be to have this level zero piece for data collection being introduced. Is that what we're putting forward, or am I missing something?
Let me jump in real quick here, Barry. One other thing, and that's that fourth reason for denial.
case of hijacking one.
Yeah.
So with that
exception,
yeah, you nailed it. That's perfect.
And just to bolt on, the, not only the fourth reason, but the time frame in which it could be, per Barbara's suggestion earlier, up to best effort up into 3 calendar days or whatever registries would be willing to sign on for. But, yes, that in essence is the proposal, and I would in fact enjoy if maybe either Simonetta or Mikey would do the presenting, because you guys do it in a more summarized basis than I do. I get down into the weeds pretty easy. But, yes, I agree.
Mikey, do you want to volunteer? I have a pretty full week this week. I don't know
if I'll get around
to go back to the transcript.
Yeah, I can do that. Basically, I think what I would do is push the draft that's already there out as the document to discuss. Do in terms of the preamble that you put in, that this part of the call is being transcribed too, right, Barry?
Right.
Recorded, not transcribed.
Yeah. Right, so I can come back to the MP3 for that. I'm happy to do that.
So, yeah, Mikey, maybe sometime later this week we can get together and strategize real quick, and then if we want to make any changes to the document, then we'll do that and then send it out by end of the week so people can review in time. And Marika said she'll make sure that ETRP is the first line item for the next call
on
the agenda.
Great.
So that's all I have.
Simonetta, maybe what I'll do is put you in as a review person, just to take a quick read before we launch, just to make sure I've captured it right. Would you be okay with that?
Sure.
Thanks.
Okay, that's all I have for today. Any other comments or questions before we bring this to a close? Sounds good. So thank you, everyone, and we'll talk next week.
Thanks, Barry. Great job.
Thanks, Barry.
Thank you.